This episode of Dear Hank and John is brought to you by Blue Land. Did you know that about 5 billion, billion? That's I checked that because that's a lot. Plastic hand soap and cleaning bottles are thrown away every year. And if that's not bad enough, most cleaning formulas are 90% water, which is heavy. We're shipping around all this water using fuel when we don't have to. Every year, Americans throw away 25% more trash from Thanksgiving to New Year. This year, maybe turn the New Year's resolution into action that makes a difference by switching to Blue Land. Blue Land is on a mission to eliminate single-use plastic by reinventing cleaning essentials to be better for you and the planet with the same powerful clean you're used to. It's a simple idea. They have refillable cleaning products. They have a nice design. I have them in my home. It looks nice on your counter. You fill the reusable bottles with water, drop in the Blue Land tablets, wait for them to dissolve, and you never have to grab bulky, heavy cleaning supplies on your grocery run ever again. And refills, because they're small and you don't have to ship a bunch of water across the country, starts at just $2.25. You can even set up a subscription or buy in bulk for additional savings. From cleaning sprays to hand soap, toilet bowl cleaner, and laundry tablets, everybody, you know what I mean. All Blue Land products are made with clean ingredients that you can feel good about. Blue Land is trusted in over a million homes, including, yeah, mine. Blue Land has a special offer for listeners. Right now, you can get 15% off your first order by going to blueland.com/dearhank. You won't want to miss it. blueland.com/dearhank for 15% off. Again, blueland.com/dearhank to get 15% off.
Hello, and welcome to Dear Hank and John.
Or as I prefer to think of it, Dear John and Hank.
It's a comedy podcast about death and also other stuff in which two brothers, Hank and John Green, will give you dubious advice, bring you all the week's news from both Mars and AFC Wimbledon, answer your questions, and I forgot.
Give you dubious advice.
Give you dubious. How you doing, John?
I'm all right. I'm proofreading right now, or I'm like dealing with the proofreader's queries for Turtles All the Way Down, my new book coming out October 10th, available for pre-order now at probablysignturtles.com.
So when people when there's something spelled wrong in your book, they're like, hey, did you want to keep this spelled wrong, or do you want to like have it be spelled right now?
That is one of the issues, but it's also like, should you capitalize the T in FaceTime is an issue. Then there's the big difficult questions word choice questions between what is technically the correct word and the word that everyone says, like which is better to pick in that situation. Mm-hmm. And it really, proofreading gets down to like those parts of grammar where you're forced to think about why grammar exists, which is sort of interesting, but also I've only had like 3 hours of sleep, so it's a little exhausting right now. How are you?
Good. John, do you know about 80%ing?
No, what is 80%ing?
80%ing is the idea that the first 80% of the work is actually only 20% of the work, and the last 20% is like 80% of the work. So getting 80% of the way there is 20%, and then the last 20% is like 80% of the work. And so what you should do is just forget about that last 20% and say, hey, look, if there's a bunch of words spelled wrong in this book, that's because I only wanted to get 80% of the way there. I had other stuff to do. I had to sleep. I have children. I have a podcast with my brother Hank. I have to be sharp and I have to be good and funny, and I'm not going to worry about whether FaceTime has a capital T.
Well, I'll tell you what, Hank. I 80%, 99% of my professional life. I 80% every Vlogbrothers video for the last 8 years. So just let me have this one thing that I spend a lot of time on.
I should just make a video on 80%ing, and it should just end like 80% of the way through. Just stop. No. I'll see you on Tuesday. Just yeah.
It's conceptually strong. I don't know if I would actually enjoy watching it though.
Oh, John, 101 episodes. How are you feeling?
Great. Couldn't be happier. Just a little bit tired due to the lack of the sleeping. I think that I'm not going to, I will get some sleep once this book goes into production in mid-August. But until then, I'm just going to be the little engine that could. Hank, would you like a short poem for today?
Hey, yes, I would.
All right, this this short poem is from Emily Bronte, but it was published under her nom de plume, Ellis Bell. And also, I'm not going to read the whole thing. It was sent to me by a listener named Sylvia, who suggested it because we always talk about that Emily Dickinson poem, With Hope is the Thing with Feathers, and she wanted me to read this poem because it's much more negative about hope, but I'm only going to read the final stanza. Hope, whose whisper would have given balm to all my frenzied pain, stretched her wings and soared to heaven, went, and ne'er returned again. Hope, by Emily Bronte. A story about hope leaving and never returning.
Hope is the thing with feathers. It flies away from you and does not come back.
That's right.
All right, John, we got a first question. It's from Ben, who asks, Dear Hank and mainly John, where would I pre-order a paperback version of your book Turtles All the Way Down that's coming out? My girlfriend and I both greatly dislike hardcover books. I like turtles, Ben.
All right. Unfortunately,
you have bad news for Ben.
Yeah. I have bad news for Ben, but then I also have more bad news for Ben. The first piece of bad news is that my book, Turtles All the Way Down, is not very deeply concerned with turtles.
It's like turtle free. It's like how many turtles are in the book, John? Is it like a low turtle book?
I would say it's not a no turtle book, but it's definitely a low turtle book. So if you're looking for a high turtle book, I actually have a recommendation.
Yeah?
Yeah. Which is rare, but I do. I have a good recommendation of a turtle heavy book. It's called The People in the Trees, and it's by Hanya Yanagihara, and it's very good. So if you're looking for a turtle book, check that one out. However, if you're looking to read my new book in paperback, I would advise patience. So the reason books come out in hardcover before they come out in paperback is there's a bunch of reasons, but the main one is that hardcover books are more expensive and the royalties are better, much, much, much better for authors. So authors are usually in favor of hardcovers coming out before paperbacks. One thing that you could do, though, is you could rip off the hardcover and then just kind of glue all the pages together and then put on your own softcover, and that might suit your interests better. Mm-hmm. But I think hardcover books are beautiful, and this book will be very beautiful. I have seen some of the like comps for what it's going to look like.
Have you seen a cover?
I've seen a cover, but I've also seen all the little detailed stuff that I really love in books, the way they bind the books, the quality of the paper, all that stuff is really good. Like it's finally, in terms of a physical item, it's finally all of my dreams coming true. So I'm sorry, Ben, but I also think that you're going to like the physical book available for pre-order now at probablysignedturtles.com.
I like the idea of just getting your X-Acto knife out and being like, ramp, ramp, that those things are gone. It's about personal preference.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I won't be mad. I mean, the book belongs to you, so do what you want with it. But the paperback will eventually come out, and I'm sorry that it's going to take a while. But I have worked very hard and fought to make sure that the hardcover is relatively inexpensive. In fact, cheaper than lots of paperback novels coming out these days. This question comes from Maya, who writes, Dear Green Brothers, what would be the ecological effects if all mosquitoes died? If there was a virus or something that eradicated all mosquitoes, would ecosystems go to chaos or would we get along fine? I'm asking because mosquitoes are the devil's spawn, and also they spread diseases that kill a lot of people. Thanks for asking. Valor Margulis, but mosquitoes first. Maya.
Nice. Mosquitoes, yeah. All men must die. But mostly, I mean, by men, I mean mosquitoes. You know, first of all, we don't have to kill all mosquitoes. There are so many species of mosquitoes that aren't the ones that bug us that much. And there are only a few species of mosquitoes that transmit malaria, and which is the biggest mosquito problem. And then so you really only have to like hit a couple of species for it to be a really big difference. But I think for the most part, we'd be okay. Like there's stuff that eats mosquitoes, but those things eat other things too. This idea that the entire ecosystem is in balance and it like everything has its place, like ticks, no, just they should all die. They don't do anything useful. They just spread disease and suck blood. Like They work. They function ecologically. They do a just fine job. But no, yeah, we could definitely get rid of the mosquitoes that are the worst offenders without any problems. In fact, we have tried and we continue to try and we have succeeded in some places.
Yeah, I mean, there used to be a lot of malaria in North America and now there's none. So there has been a lot of progress, but we have a long, long way to go. There is actually an article in Nature about this, Hank, and it has a great, I won't read you the whole article because like most articles in Nature, it's a bit of a difficult read, but it has a great subheadline. Eradicating any organism would have serious consequences for ecosystems, wouldn't it? Not when it comes to mosquitoes.
That's all you really need. We did a SciShow on it too, if you want to watch that. It's probably a little more penetrable than the Nature article.
Okay, we have another question, and this one is one of those big, difficult questions. It comes from Ashley. Mm-hmm,
okay.
Dear Brothers Green, I was babysitting for a family I don't know very well, and the baby took his first steps while I was there.
That's cute.
Should I tell the parents, Ashley?
Oh, man. No, definitely don't do that.
What?
Yeah, no. Because everybody's always like, I don't know, I want to be there when Oren takes his first steps, and I might not be, and like, I'll be bummed if I'm not. So, like, just, like, who gets hurt by that lie of omission? You don't have to be like, well, hey, guys, your baby definitely didn't take any steps while you were gone. Not a walker, that one.
See, I would argue that if anything, you should lie in the other direction. You should be like, listen, not only did your baby take his first steps, he also said his first word, and it was Ashley. It was my name. He looked me dead in the eyes, and he said, hello, Ashley. I love you more than I love my mother. And that was all he said. It was weird.
And then he was like, and then he said, I know they're only paying you $20 an hour, and that's crap. Don't accept it. I'm worth so much more than that. And that's what he said. That's all. And then he stopped and he clammed up and he hasn't said anything since. So I don't know. That's just take what you will from that.
Walked all the way across the room, told me he did not approve of my compensation package, and then clammed right back up. Anyway, really a pleasure to babysit for your astonishingly verbal, extremely mobile child.
Yeah.
See you next time.
Is it possible that I could get some equity in this baby? Because I put a lot in. just a low percentage. I don't know. How does it work?
Is that how you think babies work, Hank? That like you currently own 100% of Oren's future earnings?
I don't own 100% of Oren's future earnings, but I definitely am entitled to a percentage.
I look forward to the conversation that you have with Oren when he enters the workforce.
No. It's not initial compensation. It's only after I'm old and in the home when I expect him to contribute to the keep dad in diapers and you know, Scientific American subscriptions.
Wait, you don't think our parents are expecting that, do you?
You know, I think it's going to depend.
I nominate you, as I do so often.
All right.
I just to be clear, though, Ashley, no. You should not tell the parents that you saw the baby take his first steps.
Okay, John's come around, and he's decided to.
Unless you are directly asked.
Yeah.
And then I guess maybe you have to say yes, but even then, probably not.
Yeah. John has abandoned the bit. And he wants to make sure that you don't actually tell them. This question comes from Bree, who asks, Dear Hank and John, I recently started dating someone, and everything's great. He's super sweet, he makes me laugh, and I have a great time when I'm with him. But I recently found out that he has a not-so-tiny following online. He's somewhat of a popular YouTube person, and he has a decent amount of Twitter followers, enough to where people notice and stop him when we're out, and they want pictures. I never wanted a life in the public eye, and with the growing maliciousness of the YouTube community, I'm not sure that I could handle it. How do I handle this budding relationship while also handling keeping myself out of the public eye, if that is even possible? Completely lacking a sign-off, Bree. Oh my. Surprise. Yeah. Surprise YouTube celebrity boyfriend.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that's a great question for our spouses because they both unexpectedly developed surprise YouTube husbands well into the relationship.
Yep.
But at least with that, there was a measure of, I don't know, there was a little bit of buy-in. Like Sarah was in favor of Brotherhood 2.0 as a concept.
Sure, yeah. It was like, and it happened somewhat gradually. It wasn't like, and surprise. And there were lots of decisions along the way. that they were involved in.
That said, it's hard.
Yeah,
I think it's hard.
Yeah, I mean it's also weird because I don't think that, you know, traditional celebrity is the same necessarily, and so like you're kind of an unmapped territory here. So I don't know that anyone has particularly good advice for you except for people who have been in this exact position before. But I will say that when you talk about the maliciousness of the YouTube community, it isn't necessarily in that person's part of the community. There are lots of areas of YouTube that are like just kind and supportive, and maybe are smaller, but are big enough that people will still get recognized at the grocery store or whatever. And that is the way that fame has changed, where, you know, 99% of people have no idea who your boyfriend is, probably, but 1% is a lot. Like, you see more than 100 people if you go to the grocery store. Maybe not, but at some grocery stores, I feel like I do. That place just is full of people. And so it might... I think that it has to come down to the individual, like, situation. But also, like, that's a pretty... Is that a cool thing? Like, is that also kind of dope? Like, is there also, like, opportunities that, like, neat things will happen that you wouldn't otherwise have happen, where you get to have experiences and do things?
Yeah, I don't know. I think it depends on the person, but I do think you have to be realistic that you are...
Yeah,
at least until the moment when the person you're dating starts talking about you online, I think you're relatively anonymous. After that, you know, there is an element of not being fully anonymous. And to be honest, this is something, in a way, Hank and I have never been through the worst parts of, because we've never had like a public breakup, which is where I think it's really hard, and where you do see some viciousness at times, even in very supportive communities. So I totally get the concern, but I also think. Until and unless you're explicitly mentioned, I think you can kind of fly under the radar.
Yeah, there are certain kinds of YouTube content that like ask for all that person's life to be laid out in front of everyone. And if you were in a relationship with one of those people, you would know it. Like, you would know from the beginning because the camera would be out all the time. But a lot of people just like make videos that are about a certain thing and they aren't about their life. And so you don't necessarily have to be a part of their like public narrative.
Right. Speaking of public narratives, Hank, I want to answer this question. It comes from Rebecca, who writes, "Dear John and Hank, I love your podcast and it enriches my life." Rebecca, that is far too kind, literally. It is too kind about our completely suboptimal podcast. "I'm quite the Beatles fan, and the other day when I was listening to John Lennon's Imagine, my brother joined me and said that it was a wonderful song, but he didn't like the political message it was sending and something about communism. My question is, what political message does Imagine send out? And also, can I continue enjoying it once I know the truth behind it? Thankful for any advice. Rebecca."
Well,
so there's two questions here, Hank.
I want everybody to keep on the lookout for my new YouTube video, "The Truth About John Lennon's Imagine."
Oh God. That is such a genre of YouTube videos. There's two questions here. One is, can you enjoy art that you find politically reprehensible? And the other question is John Lennon's Imagine a communist song? And if so, is that so bad?
Yeah, no, I mean, first of all, even like, I don't know that you can find the, well, I feel like that, yeah, I can definitely not enjoy content because of the message it sends. Yeah.
Yes, but you also, I also think that like sometimes you can enjoy content despite the message it sends. Like, I can like a song even if there are things in it that I find objectionable.
Sure.
The answer to "is Imagine a communist song" is yeah.
Yeah, imagine no possessions. Yeah.
I wonder if you can. "No greed, no need for greed or hunger, a brotherhood of man." That's pretty Lennon-y. That's got a Lennon-y vibe. "Nothing to kill or die for." That's less Lennon-y.
There's lots of things to kill and die for if you're communist Russia.
But they do say "no religion too."
Yeah. Which is pretty, yeah. that was like, that feels, whenever, you know, whenever I hear that song, I like think about in the 60s saying like, imagine no religion. Like, whoa, hold on there, bucko. That's a danger time that you've entered. But yeah, people heard, and I think part of the message of Imagine, and what's nice about the song, is that it isn't saying like, hey, there shouldn't be religion, there shouldn't be possessions. It's just saying, let's question this. Let's look at it for a second and see what, like, where the thing is valuable and where it isn't. And without saying like, you know, without questioning it, then you don't ever get a chance to really even appreciate the good things that might come from things. So... But in the end, he does say, you may say that I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us. In kind of saying, all of these things I have asked you to imagine are things that I want to happen. But, yeah, I mean, it's a pretty commie song, but that doesn't mean it's not beautiful.
Well, also, it also doesn't mean that it's wrong.
Like, right, yeah.
I don't know. I'm not gonna get into ideology here. I do want to point out though that Hank is completely correct about the difference about saying "Imagine No Religion" in 72 or 73 when I'm gonna guess that song came out versus today, which is that then the vast majority of people in the United States at least did go to church every week. And now it is fewer than 40% and well under 40%. So, yep. Yeah,
70,
things have changed.
1971, John. Good job.
Thank you. Well, I know when the Beatles broke up, and unfortunately, I know when John Lennon was assassinated, so I knew it was somewhere in there. Mm-hmm. Let's move on to another question, Hank. This is another one I really wanted to answer today.
All right.
It comes from Peter, who writes, "Dear John and Hank, I'm a teenaged boy who is a longtime fan of the pod, and I have a conundrum. I'm very interested in knitting. However, I am scared that if I try to learn how to knit, I will be judged as a wuss or a sissy. How do I solve this problem? The jaws of death will engulf you. Peter." Well, Peter, you've already got the sign-off thing figured out, and that's great.
I don't think that there's nothing you could do here. If you're interested in a thing and you're worried about what people are going to think about you, you either don't do the thing because that the fear is too great, or you do it and you deal with it. And you look at those people and you think, why are you so silly? This is like, what about this particular activity? Which, by the way, involves giant, like, basically weapons that sometimes TSA won't even let you bring on plane. How is this in particular? Like, what happened in society that this is a thing that is supposed to be feminine when, like, clearly it has no gender?
Right. Yeah. I mean, but it is also hard when you are a teenager.
Sure.
To stand up to gender constructions and to stand up to those messages that tell you that you're going to be less of a person worth valuing if you do this or do that. That said, it is awesome. It is courageous, and it makes the world better, and it makes your life better in the long run. So I encourage you to knit like a mofo. Just Charizard that mofo to go all the way back to the beginning of this podcast. I hope you find it, man. I hope you find the will to knit. I think that would be mm-hmm. awesome.
And I think you also got to recognize that what's going to happen to you is what happens to 95% of knitters, is like, you figure it out and you start doing it, and then it's like, oh yeah, okay, I get it. I don't really need to make sweaters for the rest of my life.
I don't know, actually. You might not find that. You might find that it's super fun and challenging,
yeah,
and interesting.
I'm just saying,
to make
sweaters. That's what happens to most people, just having watched my friends go through their knitting craze. But also, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's not going to come back later. You have a skill that's always there ready for you to apply it, you know, especially post-apocalypse. Like, making like useful things out of strings is definitely a good thing to be able to do.
Great point, Hank.
Yeah.
Great point. It reminds me, in fact, that today's podcast is brought to you by Knitting. Knitting, an amazing post-apocalyptic talent.
Oh, so good. This podcast is also brought to you by Turtle Books. Books about turtles. They're books with high quantities of turtles, a recommended daily value, completely satisfied 150% of turtles, but that, which is not John's book, Turtles All the Way Down.
Today's podcast is also brought to you by Nothing to Kill or Die For. Wouldn't that be nice?
Are you listening to anything on Audible right now, John?
I'm listening to Jane Austen's Persuasion.
Oh, look at that.
Yeah.
That's available.
It's good.
I'm listening right now to the second book in the Expanse series, Caliban's War by James S.A. Corey, which is so good. The first one is also very good. When I'm listening to a series of books, I love like sticking like that it sticks with the same narrator, and I get this feeling that like the Harry Bosch series by Michael Connelly is like that, where you just like get so connected with the narrator and his voice for telling the story. I love that, and yeah, the Expanse series is fantastic. The show is great, and the books are great, and there's way more of the books than there is of the show, so you can be in the world longer, which is exciting for me. And I just finished The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, which also was fantastically read and very super freaking interesting. I've been told over and over and over again that I need to read this book, and I kind of sometimes have a hard time reading nonfiction on paper. But this was like such a good cohesive story that kept driving through it, and like kept me wanting to listen to the next chapter, that I was really glad I listened to it as an audiobook.
Yeah, I loved that book. I read it with words, but I'm sure the audiobook was good. Okay, let's go back to answering questions, Hank. This question comes from Allison, who writes, "Dear John and Hank, I'm moving out of my parents' house, bachelor degree in hand, to a new state. Birmingham, Alabama, actually. You may know a thing or two about that place. Hank was born there. I lived there for a long time. In the process of coming into my own and venturing out into this grown-up world, I've discovered that furniture is heckin' expensive. Hundreds of dollars for a chair? ? I've also realized that I'm vastly unprepared for this. I don't know how taxes work. I don't know how to set up Wi-Fi at my house. I'm curious, what were some of the things that you were blindsided by / not expecting when you became real adults? Also, if you have advice about moving to a new state, I'm all ears. Later, Vader, Allison."
I gotta say, the cost of furniture continues to shock me.
Oh, man. I remember when I bought my first couch with Sarah, because before that, I'd only ever purchased couches at garage sales and stuff.
And
I, when we moved to New York, we bought a couch. And I was in Jennifer Convertibles to buy this couch. And first off, I was like, "Sarah, why are we at this fancy furniture store?" And she was like, "This is literally the cheapest furniture store that I would ever enter." And I was like, okay. And then secondly, I was like, "Can someone explain to me why this couch is $900? Like, I still think, like, $900? Like, what does it do? Does it turn into a bed? Yes, as it happens, it did. But still.
Does it turn into a car?
Yeah.
Like, you can get a car for $900. Cars have like one couch and two chairs inside of them.
And you can sometimes find a used one that runs for just over $900. So really, it is insane how expensive furniture is. On the other hand, a lot of work goes into making them, etc., etc.
Yeah, they're hard to move around. But I will say is like what sometimes you don't realize is like living in your parents' house, it took them decades to collect all the furniture they have. They didn't start out and like buy it all at once. They probably had not so much furniture at all, and probably, you know, had a bunch that they got at thrift stores or garage sales, and then slowly got rid of the crappy things and replaced them with good things. And it's important to know that you, like, not only can't you, but you should not suddenly go into $20,000 of credit card debt furnishing a home. And
yeah,
what else?
On that note, Hank, I just want to interrupt you real quickly and say that you implied that the stuff that you get at garage sales isn't good. And I would like to say for the record that I still have one of my garage sale couches, and it remains, in some ways, it is certainly not our most physically attractive couch, but I would argue it is our most comfortable couch.
Yeah. Rugs are also something that really shocked me. And it's like, this is a thing that I step on. I just walk on this all day long. Why is this so expensive? Why am I going
to... Because they require so much work to create. That's why they're expensive.
No, yeah, it makes sense. You. Yeah, it makes sense. But yeah, I'm like, well, no rugs for me for a while. Setting up Wi-Fi, you can do it. Paying taxes, you can do it. But it's harder than setting up Wi-Fi.
I don't know. They're both very hard. I mean, I remember, I have a vivid memory of like setting up, we didn't have Wi-Fi back then. Have I ever told the story about when
you have.
My roommate came home with Wi-Fi?
Yeah.
Are you sure I have?
You have on the podcast.
Are you totally positive?
I'm like 98% sure.
I'm going to tell it again. So my roommate Shannon came home with a computer with Wi-Fi, and she was like, look, no cords, no cables. And anywhere within 50 feet of this machine that I bought that was a wireless router, I can get access to the internet. And I said, joke's on you, Shannon, because I have a 100-foot Ethernet cord. I'm glad that you laughed at my joke despite having heard it literally 4,000 times.
It's probably not the third. It's at least not the third.
Anyway, the joke's on Shannon because I figured out that wireless was a complete scam if you just owned a 100-foot Ethernet cord. And to this day, I refuse to get computers with wireless. Just kidding. I was clearly wrong about that. So it is a pain to like set up all of that stuff. But you also have to remember, Allison, that you're setting stuff up. And then once it's set up, it works.
Well, until it stops working. What I want Allison to know is that like you got to figure stuff out. That's what adulthood is. It's like, I don't know how to do this. And it's like, oh, okay, well, I'll just do it. I will say do not put washing, like washing machine, like clothes washing stuff into the dishwasher. That's a bad idea.
What?
Yeah. Or the other way around. Don't do it either way. The dishwasher has its stuff and the clothes washer has its stuff and they are not the same. They are not the same. And do not put hot oil into a milk jug is another thing to not do.
That's a good one. I'll give you one that I learned the hard way when I was 23. Sometimes you want to eat a frozen pizza and you put it in the oven at 450 degrees for 18 minutes. And then about like 4 minutes after you start cooking the pizza, you want to go bowling. And so you go bowling and you're a bit of an obsessive bowler. So you bowl by yourself for 3.5 hours. When you come home, first off, you're going to be so happy that the whole house didn't burn down. But secondly, you're going to have some really annoyed roommates.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my God, it's burning. It actually was burning, John.
It was burning.
It happened to you.
It's not a great decision by me.
Shout out to all the people who are cooking while they listen to Dear Hank and John. Make sure that you set your timer and that it's loud enough to get through your earbuds. All right, I got one last question for you. John says, Dear Brothers, it's from RJ. Do power plants produce their own electricity? How is a power plant turned on if it produces its own power? Do other power plants pay to use electricity? Do power plants have to pay to use electricity? These are the questions I need answer to. I have no use for these answers, RJ. I need answers to these questions, by which I mean I don't need answers to these questions.
Well, Hank?
I think a power plant's just like any other building. Like, the power goes out of the power plant, it goes to the place where all the power goes and gets shifted around and joins up on the grid, and then it comes back. So, yeah, you gotta make it so that if you turn off the power plant, it still has power somehow. You don't want like all the computers and TVs, because they're watching sports, I guess, and lights to turn off, just because the power plant needs maintenance. So you're on the grid like anybody else. And yeah, you got to pay for power, even if you're a power plant. Even if you're throwing it off like more than you could ever possibly use, you just tap into the grid like anybody else.
Well, that's interesting. I'm glad I learned that. Hank, before we get to the news from Mars and AFC Wimbledon, I want to read one quick correction that came in from Elliot, who had a bunch of issues with the way we talked about how we know climate change is real. In that discussion, Hank, we both said that you have to rely on experts, and the only way to know as much as a climate scientist does about climate is to be a climate scientist. Elliot broadly agreed with this, but he also pointed out that the nature of science is for it to be open and available for people to explore and to question and to use the scientific method to come to better understandings, which I think is an important point. And also, he said that it is actually not that complicated to prove to people that we know that humans are causing the Earth to get hotter. So I'm just going to read his explanation because I thought it was good. People have put tons of effort into measuring humanity's greenhouse emissions, and it lines up reasonably well with similarly large efforts to measure atmospheric carbon worldwide. Here's a NASA visualization, which we will put on the Patreon. It's a pretty straightforward physical model, say that this will cause climate change, so it's hard to see how it wouldn't affect global temperatures. And importantly, those human emissions are literally the only known factor that remotely explains the rising temperatures that we see.
Mm.
So there you go. Hank.
Yes, John.
Did anything happen on a cold, dead rock millions of miles from Earth yesterday?
No, but yes, many things happened on Mars yesterday, and other cold dead rocks as well had things happen to them. But the thing that I'm going to talk about did not actually happen on Mars. It happened here on Earth. So John, you know that they're working on a new launch system to get heavier, bigger stuff farther and faster than ever before, and so we've got this engine that's going to take us. Hopefully, if all works out as planned, and we don't need to start knitting our own shirts to Mars. this engine, you may have heard of it, John. It's called the RS-25. And when I say you've heard of it, you probably haven't heard it called that. But it's just the same engine that they used on the space shuttle. They had three of them on the main engine of the space shuttle, and it burns liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen to create water, and it throws off a tremendous amount of hot gas, and that exits very quickly from the nozzle, 13 times the speed of sound. So if it kept going that fast, it would go from Los Angeles to New York in about 15 minutes. Luckily, it doesn't, or else that would be a problem. But it basically, it's a huge engine. It's about the size of like a Honda Fit, and it has these four extremely fast turbopumps, and it's a reliable thing. We've never had significant problems with them. And we know how they work really well because we used them for a long time on the space shuttle. And instead of having three of them, the space launch system will have four of them. And they've actually changed the controller a little bit, the kind of brain that operates how the engine works, how much gas is going through it, and how the valves and pumps and things are going. Change that a little bit so that it actually produces about 10% more thrust than they did when they were used on the space shuttle. And we're doing our first tests of that new control system for the SLS, or maybe not our first, but they're testing it right now, actively testing the RS-25 engine. And if you want to watch a video of that, I'll throw that one up on the Patreon as well, because man, is it impressive. They put it in this building. I just love it. They like put it in this building, and then the building has to be anchored into the ground super hard. Is usually the problem you have is that it like you don't want a building to like you're fighting against gravity, but this building has to fight against this engine that's trying to lift it into space. So there's this giant engine that has to channel the gases as it's exiting the engine out, but it's just very impressive, and it runs for a very long time, like about 8 minutes, which does not seem like a long time until it is a giant engine that produces just massive amounts of thrust. So working on that and doing testing of it right now.
Wow, that sounds pretty exciting.
It's
actually
a pretty cool thing. Yeah, rocket science, John.
Well, the news from AFC Wimbledon is not rocket science, as they say. In fact, just moments ago, AFC Wimbledon wrapped up one of their final friendlies before the soccer season officially starts against Scunthorpe on August 5th. So it is the end of our long international nightmare, Hank. Finally, at last, we are returning to regular soccer. However, just played Aldershot Town in a preseason friendly. Aldershot Town currently playing in the fifth tier of English soccer, so not in the Football League, not mm-hmm. Not a team in the Football League.
Yep.
However, we did not lose to them. We also did not beat them. It was a 1-1 draw. Our new goalkeeper, McDonnell, had a very good game, which on the upside means that he might be very good. On the downside, that means that there were a lot of chances for Aldershot Town. So he made some very good good saves, and That is the news. We just have to hope that the preseason has been mixed results, I would say. And I think we have to have the ambition and the hope that the betting markets are right. So the betting markets, Hank, have AFC Wimbledon finishing 17th-ish. That would suit my interest just fine, because I love sponsoring a third-tier English soccer team, and it is my ambition to continue sponsoring one until one day they have a brand new stadium and maybe with some luck and some investment can become a second-tier English soccer team.
I mean, John, don't you want them to be a first-tier English soccer team, though?
I do. That would be great. And certainly all things are possible. But there would have to be some kind of collapse in the British economy that I don't want to root for. Right now, all the Premier League teams can spend like an actual $100 million every summer. So it seems pretty far away for AFC Wimbledon to be spending that kind of money. But life is full of surprises. And certainly who could have guessed that they would be promoted six times in their since being reborn. So anything is possible. I'm going to keep my fingers crossed. But in the meantime, we're not losing to Aldershot Town, which is also something.
I mean, could you, since they did so well, could you like recruit a couple Aldershot Town players, maybe?
Certainly. So I don't think that's out of the question.
Players?
I was watching Jamaica play the United States in the Gold Cup, and the Jamaican keeper was unfortunately injured, and so they had to bring in their backup keeper, who was a 30-year-old playing in the second tier of Sweden. And I was watching this second tier Swedish goalkeeper, and he was making some really good saves. And I did think, you know, I have Neil Ardley's phone number. I could text him.
Because I'm sure nobody else was watching that game.
Well, actually, it is possible that I was the only person watching that game.
I don't know. I have no idea.
Hank, what did we learn today?
Oh, John, we learned that cars have, like, a couch and two chairs in them. So why do I have to pay so much for couches and chairs?
We also learned that lying to your babysitting clients is sometimes the right thing to do.
Absolutely, 100%. And we learned that you gotta kill all those mosquitoes. So if you see a mosquito, kill a mosquito. Do not worry about the ecological consequences. And maybe if we all just work together, we can get them all, which we definitely can't.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't. I mean, if we work together, like as a species, dramatically increase funding for anti-malarial efforts, maybe. But I think just by smashing them one at a time, probably not. And lastly, we learned that Turtles All the Way Down does not have that many actual turtles in it.
It is a low turtle book, John.
Mostly a metaphor.
Hey, thanks, John, for podcasting with me.
It's my pleasure.
Who listened and sent in questions. If you would like to send in questions, you could do that at hankandjohn@gmail.com. John, you're on Twitter.
I am.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
At twitter.com/JohnGreen. I'm on Twitter at twitter.com/HankGreen.
Dear Hank and John is produced by Rosianne Hulse-Rojas and Sheridan Gibson. Our editor is Nicholas Jenkins. Victoria Bongiorno is our head of community and communications. Our music is by the great Gunnarola. Hank, we are now going to go record our extra podcast for Patreon, This Week in Ryan's, which you can find out more about over at patreon.com/DearHankandJohn. Thanks again for listening, and as we say in our hometown,
don't forget to be awesome.